Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. If you're new to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, welcome. This is a great place to start your barbell medicine journey, and you should check out some of the other podcasts we have in our library. A lot of cool information there. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. This week is episode 154. This is a question and answer session that Dr. Baraki and I did prior to the San Antonio seminar earlier this year. We recorded this in his house. Tom Campitelli, who works for us, was asking us questions from the internet. So you guys submitted questions via Instagram, I believe. He curated them, and we kind of went to town. Dr. Michael Ray was also in the house. Leo Lutz was in the background as well. So we had the whole crew there. We were answering some questions. The audio did stop recording about halfway through, so that's why this is a short one. It's only about 25 minutes, but nice little digestible nuggets of information for your commute or your daily walks or whatever you're doing. We talk about isolation versus compound exercises, programming, when to see your primary care doctor, and much, much more in this week's podcast. So that will be fun for you guys to check out. Before we hop into this week's podcast, just a few announcements. We still do have seminars coming up this year, live in-person seminars. We're going to be at Alan Thrall's gym, Untamed Strength in Sacramento, California, here in November. The Pain and Rehab team has their two-day seminar coming up in Gainesville, Florida, that is worth CEUs for physical therapists and chiropractors. So if you're interested in either or both of those, there are links to them in the description below. Also, all the new apparel that we recently dropped is live on our website, and we've restocked some of the shirts that sold out. So if you're interested in repping barbell medicine, trying to get that fresh fit going for fall, that was a lot of alliteration. I'd like some kudos for that. There's links to that in the description below. And also, we restocked our whey protein. That is available on our website with lightning fast shipping. Last announcement, we do have a new shoulder rehab template. If you have shoulder pain while training and are interested in, you know, squat, bench, deadlift, this is the template for you to try to get you back on track. We also updated nearly all of our templates. So if you've previously purchased a template from us, you get lifetime access to the updates. So you can download those with the receipt that you were sent with your template purchase. If you can't find that receipt or the link's not working, just email us support@barbellmedicine.com. We'll get you handled as soon as possible. We do have some new templates in the work as well. So we have like a super total template coming out. We got a low fatigue, kind of strength focused template coming out. And then a youth template. So we're working closely with Dr. Derek Miles on, kind of how to train youth athletes, in season and out of season. So that'll be fun. Pair that with the ebook, to kind of answer all your questions there and provide additional resources for those who are interested. So enough about that. Let's hop into this week's podcast, episode 154. This is Dr. Austin Brockie and myself answering questions from the internet. Tom is going to ask us questions from the internet, and we're going to try to answer them right here on the Barbell Medicine YouTube channel. Tom, let's do this. So should you only do compound lifts, or should you do some isolation work as well? I mean, I think this is entirely goal dependent. If you are trying to maximize strength performance, and we're defining strength as like 1 RM maximal strength, low velocity strength, I can't really make a strong case for doing a lot of isolation work, period. Because it doesn't matter what your biceps development, you know, ends up being, what your calf development ends up being. I can make some case for triceps development, but that's likely going to take course through exposure to more compound lifts. So whether it be a close grip bench press, board press, dips, etc., all those other sorts of things. So if you're just talking pure strength performance, I don't know that isolation work really has like is necessary outside of potentially some injury risk reduction stuff. If you wanted to put like Nordics in there, or like Copenhagen planks or something like that, which technically are like somewhat isolation exercises, but they're not talking about that. They're talking about biceps curls and triceps press downs and calf work or whatever. But if you want to get, if you want to be the most jacked version of yourself, then yeah, isolation work I think has a place, and there's decent evidence suggesting that you're going to get more hypertrophy out of that for particular muscle groups than from compound lifts. I'm thinking particularly about quads when you're comparing squats to leg extension and their impact on hypertrophy and hypertrophy surrogates. Same thing with triceps muscle development compared to bench press versus just triceps press downs. Doesn't mean that bench press is bad, doesn't mean that squats are bad, just that if you're really just trying to get them to grow, particularly for the lowest amount of fatigue cost from training, then you can do a lot more work, a lot more volume with the isolation stuff than the compound stuff.
Yeah, I view this kind of as a spectrum. At one end, you have like the hyper specificity folks who might say not just only compound lifts, but like only competition movements.
Sure, yeah, I wouldn't say
and
that.
And at this point, I make a fairly strong case against that, that I would not suggest that sort of training. I guess the only exception would be somebody who has goals consistent with competition and they have very limited time to train, in which case you're kind of accepting like my outcomes aren't going to be as great as they could be.
Because you don't have enough time to train enough.
But those are the main lifts. You have to be prepared to do those lifts so you can do those lifts. In between, you have a broader array of quote unquote compound movements, and you can do any variety of those. That's all good. And then on top of that, you have the level of even more variation where you start introducing more isolation work. And I agree with the idea that isolation movements can get you a lot more training in certain areas that an individual may prioritize for whatever reason with a lot less fatigue. I myself, in the past year, I would say I've actually increased how much of that kind of work, isolation or accessory type stuff that I've done. And I've found that areas that would historically have frequently flared up from like a tendinopathy standpoint when I was doing a high volume of highly specific movements, like a lot of low bar squatting all in a week, or a lot of, comp grip benching all in a week.
Sure.
Spreading that out, making it a little bit more varied, and then layering in some isolation stuff, like you mentioned, some tricep stuff, even some bicep stuff. Who knows, maybe that has some effect around the elbow. I don't know.
Sure.
But I seem to be tolerating, that particularly well. And so in general, I feel like of late, I've been biasing people's training a little bit more into the more variation realm, not taking them a ton away from comp lifts if their goal is competition and doing a ton of isolation stuff, but definitely not dismissing that stuff, because I think it can have a pretty good role for general development and then for task specific, like even if you're trying to get, trying to compete to shore areas up that may be a limitation for you, or to build tissue capacity so that they can handle more regular training with less risk of pain and injury.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and also just like filling out shirts, that can be cool.
If you're into that. There was this one guy on a forum, the old forum that we were previously on, that was like, he saw that I was doing biceps curls and like I would program biceps curls for people. And he was like, why would you do that? And I was like, well, one, I think most people, particularly if they're interested in strength and conditioning, like want to train their arms anyway. And let's do it in a systematic way. You know, we provide enough training to get a result, but also not so much that they're not unable to tolerate it, and then they don't grow, they don't get any stronger, whatever. And he's like, do you think Mike T would do biceps curls? And I was like, yes, 100%. If he had more time, he would do all of the lifts. And that's exactly what Mike said to me. He's like, if I had more training time, I would do everything. I would do more biceps, I'd do more triceps, I'd do more deltoid stuff. Like he would do it all. And the whole thing is like, if you have unlimited time to train and unlimited time to train your capacity to get so high, you can do it all. But the real problem is when people hear this, they're like, oh, so the barbell medicine guys say, go do all this isolation work. And it's like, not so fast. Start with a low amount of volume, work up over time, because you don't grow from necessarily doing more volume. You're going to grow from being able to tolerate the volume that you're exposed to and not just be treading water, trying to keep pace. The idea is like, oh, I can deal with this volume, I can deal with this training, and then you can actually grow from that rather than just overloading yourself all at once. The question is, can you tear your meniscus from squatting? Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. You can tear your meniscus doing anything. You could be on the toilet, not actively moving. You could be rising from the toilet, getting down onto the toilet, couch, you could be walking. Yeah, you could be doing any of that stuff and tear your meniscus or be symptomatic from a previously torn meniscus is the other thing, right? So you'd actually have to get an imaging directly before a singular rep of the lift and then have some sort of indication that you need to get imaging directly afterwards and show a, you know, bona fide image, like tear on image. And you'd be like, wow, that's just when it happened. And it can't be from the walk out or the walk in. So you'd have to have people take the weight from you, right? So could it happen? Sure. But I guess the real question is probably baked in here is like, should you avoid squatting if you have a torn meniscus? Or should you avoid squatting? And should you avoid squatting if you don't want to tear your meniscus? And both of those things, I would say you should probably squat. Or some sort of lower extremity compound exercise that targets all the musculature of the lower extremities and, you know, gets you somewhat close to failure multiple times per week. That'd be the overall like training.
Yeah. Training I think goal. It's exceptionally difficult to prove, you know, that it happens during a particular moment in time, as you said. And it's similarly difficult to prove that it is the sole driver of your pain symptoms.
That's
highly unlikely. And so I just think that this is something that should not be of concern to most people because so many people, as we've talked about in other contexts, have these kind of findings. If we go looking for them, take pictures of people's knees, we can find evidence of a torn meniscus. And obviously the word torn kind of spooks people and it makes them think that it is, you know, damaged and needs to be fixed or that it is a major problem. But it's super common. It's really essentially impossible to know when it happens. And it's really difficult to say how closely related it is to your knee pain. And I would say overarching all of this is thinking about, okay, whether it is due to that or not due to that, whether I have one or I don't have one, if my knee hurts, what do I do about it? And the presence or absence of that in most situations does not really impact how we would recommend you approach your knee pain. And that has a lot to do with some of the other content we've put out on managing pain in training. So wouldn't sweat it.
Yep. I do not think that squatting increases your risk of tearing a meniscus. I do not think that squatting increases your risk of having pain from a previously torn meniscus. In fact, I'd argue for the opposite relationship. If you start the correct loading, tempo, range of motion, etc., work somebody through that, you can actually reduce their symptomology and sensitivity to the squat. And then I don't know that I would avoid squatting for any particular reason, unless you really just do not want to squat and that's preventing you from doing any sort of resistance training. In which case,
pick something else.
You could leg press.
Yeah.
How regularly should a 36-year-old healthy male see their physician? This is a great question. So with that recent paper that we shared about like just...
The routine health check. I think it was in JAMA last month in June or July 2021.
Yeah. We'll link that in the description below so you guys can check that out. To answer your question, I think if somebody has no medical history, personal medical history, and their family medical history is benign as far as they know, meaning that nobody had like a heart attack or, you know, dropped dead from a cardiovascular problem early on in life or, you know, colon cancer that was discovered early on, it's going to be difficult to make an evidence-based case for you should see a doctor yearly for a checkup. It's going to be, there are no like routine labs that you need to draw on a yearly basis to like maintain health or even screen effectively for health. The current screening tool that we use, the AHRQ. AHRQ effectively uses your demographic data and some other lifestyle data to like kind of spell out like here are the recommended screening, and most of those for a 36-year-old male are going to be for STIs, sexually transmitted infections, and then if you have no family history of anything else, that's, you know.
Yeah, I think the most frequent recommendation would be an annual blood pressure check, mm-hmm. Which again, that can be checked in a variety of settings.
Yeah.
By that age, by 36, most people should have had, the recommendation would be that you have had a blood lipid or a blood cholesterol panel checked. And if you had that checked and it was normal, then you are okay to recheck it in 5 years from that point. At least that's also the guideline there. And then yes, the rest has to do with lifestyle, behaviors, family history, particularly like of early colon cancer, early heart disease, things like that. Mm-hmm. But outside of those things, I would like to reiterate very clearly what you said, that there are no routine blood tests that need to be checked on an annual basis for people in that demographic who are healthy, who do not have existing medical problems. That includes a complete blood count, that includes a complete metabolic panel, that includes a thyroid stimulating hormone, that includes a vitamin D, that includes all the things that I very frequently get asked to check on folks. And definitely if it's being requested to be checked yearly, there is no reason to check those things at all in individuals in that demographic who are healthy, no prior medical history, no symptoms, does not need to be done. So principally has to do with blood pressure screening annually in some fashion. Again, that doesn't even have to be with a physician.
Yep.
Substance use disorders, things like alcohol use, things like that, other high risk lifestyle behaviors, and then certain family history aspects. Even the guideline or even the recommendation for like depression screening is quite controversial because of risks of overdiagnosis, overtreatment in that situation too.
Yeah.
So yeah, you probably don't need to see somebody as frequently as you may think.
Yeah, I think there's a weight screening in there too.
Yeah.
Yeah, for like dietary intervention counseling. But so Leonard Pops is, every year. And I just got my yearly. Yearly what? And he's like, what do you mean? You know, my yearly, my labs.
Yeah.
And I was like, why? And he's like, you know, the CBCs. And I'm like, I know what it is. I'm like, why though? And he's like, my doctor. My doctor wanted me to do it. So your doctor may have a different view on this than we do. And that's fine. We would refer you to the paper linked in the description below. And we're just reporting the facts here. Interpret them as you will.
So the question is, I haven't hit a PR in a long time.
What do?
What do?
Yeah. Yeah, question. Yeah. If you haven't hit a PR in a long time, what do? Without knowing more about this, like where somebody is in their training trajectory and career, it's really hard to say. Like if somebody's been training for 15 years and they haven't hit a PR in 2 years, I'm less inclined to like ring the alarm bell and be like, we got to do something and find the answer. It's like, you know, sometimes that happens. You can get it, be on an injury streak. You could have other life stuff going on that's detracting you from training productively. And you might not even be aware of that, just like life and environmental stress. That can all happen. But if somebody's like, yeah, I've been training with weights for 6 months and then after that, hadn't hit a PR for 2.5 years. I'm like, one, what did the first 6 months look like?
Yeah.
And then like, you know, what's going on now? Like, I'd be curious about injury history and programming and stuff. So if somebody hasn't been PRing at some sort of like regular interval, or at least building momentum towards trying, almost setting PRs, you just really want to look at the programming as far as the first thing I'm looking at, is it appropriate for the goals that they're trying to achieve? So if someone's primarily strength-minded, you know, are they training in rep ranges, at intensity ranges that like promote maximal strength development? If no, like, okay, well, let's change that. Are they using exercises that they're testing their strength in? Like, you know, again, these are very rudimentary sort of concepts, but people just picking programs, they're like, oh, I'm on a bodybuilding program and my squat didn't go up. It's like,
okay. We need to line those things up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, not necessarily surprised. If that seems to be in line. Then the next thing I'm going to is the dose. And I think most people would assume that we're saying, oh, you're just not training enough. You need to do more. But it could be the opposite, meaning that you're training a lot right now and you're able to kind of tolerate it, meaning that you're, you know, you can maintain performance week to week, or it kind of goes down a little bit and it kind of stays down, but you're injured relatively frequently. You know, every third or fourth week, some tweak comes up and like derails your progress. To me, that sort of indicates, you know what, maybe the dose is like a little too high right now for what you can tolerate. And instead of you being able to, again, tolerate, adapt, and then thrive on that training volume, it's actually kind of just keeping you down. You're just trying to tread water and not necessarily making it. And so you can adjust it either way. Or the training volume at that given intensity level. I mean, that there, you can't talk about one without talking about the other. So in general, the way I look at this is the training appropriate to your goal? And are you doing too much or not enough of it? And if all of those things check out, then I'm starting to look at like, what are your expectations going into a training session? How are you trying to progressively load yourself? I had a guy who was running one of our templates. He's like, my squat hasn't gone up. And I'm like, okay, well, what are you squatting, you know? And I don't remember the exact weight. I think the low 200 somewhere. He's like, yeah, I just kept doing the same weight. And I was like, but, and why though? He's like, well, the calculator said that my estimated 1RM was the same. And so I just kept loading the same for my last warm-up set and then my work sets. And I'm like, have you tried adding more weight? You know, like on days that your warm-up set, for example, didn't feel quite as heavy. He's like, well, the calculator though, it said to just add this. And I can understand that, but at the same time, it's like, if on days that you're feeling very strong, I think you need to take advantage of that. That's one of the joys of, or one of the benefits of RPE. On days that you're not feeling so great, you don't, you know, you're still trying
adjust
to
adjust accordingly.
Yeah, you're still trying to get the right dose of training stimulus. So that's kind of how I would look at it. Anything else you want to put in there?
Yeah, the other part of this is that an individual going through this process may feel overwhelmed with all of those variables and like deciding how do I modify these things. And
sure.
It may, you know, maybe part of the reason why they pursued a kind of a stock program is because they're like, I can't figure all this stuff out for myself. In which case, the expectation that you can then figure out what steps to take next with it may also be unreasonable, and you may need to get some guidance, for example.
The coaching,
It's like pursuing a coaching relationship, somebody you trust who can help walk you through the process, because particularly somebody who's experienced, because they've probably been through this before too. I mean, coaches have PR droughts, as both of us have had at some point in our training careers.
That's happened.
And figuring out how to get around that process can be pretty valuable experience to then impart onto somebody else. If coaching is not really an option for you, for whatever reason, be it financial or another reason, and you're not sure what to do with your particular existing programming, then I think the last choice is just pick any other program and see if you respond to it.
Sure, yeah.
that's like if I have no access to resources and I don't know what to do based on the variables that have been explained to me, then just try something else.
Yep.
Even if it's temporarily something that is not in line perfectly with your goals, take, mm-hmm. you know, do something like another style of training, do other exercise, do other stuff. Maybe you'll, you know, psychologically it'll be a reset for you, and then come back to what you enjoy doing and maybe you'll blow up again. You know, that's happened to various points in our training careers too.
Do you think that by hiring a coach that you cut off the learning curve or that you make the learning curve steeper? Yeah. Just say, all right, if you're watching this on YouTube, just comment below. Like, if you increase the rate at which someone is learning a skill, is it cutting off the learning curve or you're making the learning curve steeper? I want to know below.
Leah, I don't want to know.
Leah chuckles.
I will not look at the YouTube comments.
All right. What level of activity is no longer considered sedentary? In the research, this is meeting the aerobic guidelines. So the 150 to 300 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic training, or 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous intensity aerobic training, or some combination of the two, which is what 500 to 1,000 minutes per week. When they did this with just walking, the sedentary cut point was at like 6,000 steps per day. So the average adult American, just in their day-to-day life, if they wear a pedometer 24 hours a day, takes between 6,000, 7,000 steps. Some individuals with certain medical conditions take less, although some individuals with certain medical conditions take more, like diabetics on average take more steps than the average. COPD patients take less steps. So it really depends on this, like who you're asking and why you're asking them. Because if you ask researchers, they're going to come up with a very specific answer here. If you ask me, I'm just going to say the physical activity guidelines for adults, which includes those aerobic training goals and also twice weekly resistance training. And if you're not meeting all of those, you have a physical inactivity or physical activity level that is insufficient. Doesn't mean you're like completely sedentary, but it's just insufficient physical activity.
I'll come at this slightly differently.
Ooh, good.
The reason why researchers have a cutoff is for the purposes of research.
Sure.
Because you have to, so that you can dichotomize groups, meaning you can split people into groups and compare them. And the guidelines are what they are for reasons that we've discussed in some of our other content. If I were an individual, like the person asking, who I'm presuming is asking this question, I would really try to take my focus away from the label sedentary, right? Because the question was like, at what level am I no longer considered sedentary? Like, sure, what level can I like rip this label off that says, boom, like I've graduated? And so that kind of, because it generates like this false dichotomy of like, I'm sedentary or I'm not sedentary. Whereas instead, the reality of it is it's a giant spectrum.
Yeah, just physical
and
activity.
It's not only is it a spectrum of activity, but there's a spectrum of associated risk with that. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a curvy linear relationship, if it's just a curve of risk related to your level of activity, and we say, where are we going to put the cutoff for when you're sedentary?
Sure.
Not, it's like, you know, just, we'll put it here. And it is not meaningful whether you're on just this side of the curve or on just this side of the curve. Your risk is relatively similar. So I'd kind of view it more as this is just a spectrum of activity. If I'm very low relative to the guidelines, then I can recognize I'm a little bit higher risk or potentially at a lot higher risk.
Sure.
And the further I get into and towards the higher end, say, of those guidelines, I'm bringing my risk down. So it's this continuous relationship, not a split dichotomous one. The label is less useful when you're, you know, talking about people or like telling them like you are a sedentary person or something like that.
Sure,
instead, it's just a spectrum of activity and a spectrum of risk.
Yeah. I think that the risk of physical inactivity does go up precipitously once you get below the minimums.
But we also know that your risk goes down fairly continuously up to very high levels
of
activity.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Do I prefer high bar or low bar squats? In competition, I prefer a low bar because I personally can lift a little more weight. In training, though, I would prefer the high bar squat. And if I didn't have any competitions coming up, I would probably just do high bar squats. All right, that's a wrap on this week's podcast, episode 154. Thank you so much for listening. Before you go, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you the latest nuance in health and fitness. We'll see you here next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. See ya.